So, delighted to be back with Andy Worthington. We're going to be putting the world to rights over the next hour and a bit. And we inevitably start with the debacle in Gaza, which, since we last spoke, has inevitably got quite a lot worse. But we've had some interesting developments, such as 100 staffers on the BBC deciding that up with this, they will not put in terms of perceived bias. We've had a continual process mounting. Andy, take up the story. What are you saying?
Well, yes, lovely to be talking to you again, Andy. And, you know, it's now 13 months, isn't it? And, you know, I still find that in my dealings with people in my everyday life, people who are capable of understanding the importance of empathy in our lives. Fundamentally, I think it is empathy. You know, we're living through an unspeakable horror from afar, and we're powerless. We can't do anything about it. Our leaders are not interested. But and you know, it's almost entirely, what's really happening is almost entirely unreported outside of social media. Social media has been so important for this, in terms of Palestinian journalists who've managed to survive.
And many of them
the extraordinary number. It's nearly up to 200 journalists now that have been killed by Israel.
That's
in the last
13
months.
Unprecedented in modern warfare.
It's more than the Second World War and the Vietnam War combined.
Yeah.
So yeah, we're in this position where we're not even hearing much of what the truth is, and certainly, you know, since we last spoke, I mean, the most recent developments have been, we had the anniversary of the October 7th attacks, and we had Israel killing Yahya Sinwar, the leader of Hamas, and the hope, I'm sure, that a lot of people had that you know, an anniversary of something so horrendous to have been going on for a year would surely mean something had to be put in place to try and see an end to it. And what happened instead is that Israel has started this absolutely horrendous genocide within a genocide in northern Gaza. And the Western media have been incredibly slow to pick up on it. You know, I came across it in September because certain Israeli commentators, and actually I think CNN and The Guardian picked up on it at the time, were talking about a plan that was floated by a retired Israeli general, Giora Eiland.
Oh, yes.
Who's made the most atrocious comments ever since October the 7th. But the plan that he floated was that moving on from the first year of the genocide, where basically what Israel did was bomb the hell out of Gaza from north to south and push everyone down from the north to the south, where, you know, this untold number of people are living in makeshift tents, in disease-ridden, garbage-strewn, sewage-overflowing camps. But people in the north and the centre of Gaza refused to leave, or were unable to leave, in their hundreds of thousands. And so what he was proposing was we have to entirely ethnically cleanse the north of Gaza, up to 400,000 people who are still there. Like I say, some who chose not to obey the evacuation orders, which were illegal anyway, but others who cannot leave their homes. People who are ill, people who are very elderly, completely discounted. And the way he proposed it was that the evacuation orders would be issued for the entire population of northern Gaza, 400,000 people. Within a week, if they didn't comply, then they would all be regarded as combatants. If as a civilian you didn't comply with this evacuation order, you would immediately be regarded as a combatant. That's completely illegal under international humanitarian law. Civilians can't magically become combatants because you issued an evacuation order. But that was the plan. The plan was horrendous. And then the reality was that they started implementing an even more malignant version of the plan while refusing to admit to the West that that's what they were doing. And that's why I say the mainstream media just wasn't watching it, or was reporting a huge uptick in violence involving just entire residential homes being wiped out, massacre after massacre, with a loss of like 100 people, women and children mostly, snipers and quadcopters roaming the streets, killing people who were actually trying to obey the evacuation orders. And they started a starvation policy. Ireland's plan was that they would, the people who were left would not only be regarded as combatants, terrorists, but would also be starved. They started the starvation first. Then when people were supposed to flee, they were killing them as they were trying to do that. And now all that they're doing is they're just destroying. Their massacres are happening every day. Hospitals again are being invaded and besieged and bombed and shut down, and doctors are once more being seized and disappeared into the horrendous prison system. And it's an intensification of what they did, what they've been doing over the last year. But almost as though the rationale behind it is, we told everyone to leave, and we, you know, we destroyed the country. So now we're going back to finish off the ones who we didn't get the first time round. So if you thought you were lucky enough not to have been killed over the last year because you stayed, we're coming back to terminate you now. That, this is it. Just
after a generous extension of longevity. Yeah.
You know, and not just there, of course, Andy, because they've, you know, they're bombing and have made attempts to invade. Mainly they're bombing southern Lebanon with exactly the same plan as Gaza, to destroy it and depopulate it. And this is a sovereign country. This doesn't even involve the issues of the fact that, you know, their response in Gaza is supposed to be because of Hamas. Their response in southern Lebanon now, to ethnically cleanse the whole of southern Lebanon and destroy it, is because Hezbollah has been firing rockets at them. So we're reaching a point where does it stop? What does Israel regard as acceptable to defend itself? And it seems to be the complete elimination of everybody who could constitute any kind of threat to it in the immediate vicinity. Presumably, the radius expanding if nobody stops them. It's just beyond belief, really.
It's infantile, isn't it? I mean, I suppose you could argue that this, you could wind this back to the Six-Day War and their initial conquest, but the context of the ownership of the region being pretty much uncontestable. There have also been rumblings, I believe, about whether Israel, even with its humongous enterprise and other departments and its important defence industries across the world, can actually afford this. I'm also thinking about the mental health of the people prosecuting this. And, for example, what happened towards the end of Vietnam, where people were being given illicit drugs to keep going and doing the horrendous things that they did, and then, went back highly traumatised.
Well, I think both of those are really significant points, Andy. I think the Israeli economy is suffering, despite the fact that it has, you know, impressive weapons sectors and impressive tech sectors. And quite often, you know, both of those working in conjunction.
Indeed, yeah.
The armed quadcopters, I think, are a particularly horrendous Israeli innovation that, you know, authoritarians around the world will be wanting to get their hands on.
These are drone-based,
literally,
aren't
just
they?
Send the thing out someone sits in a warehouse somewhere. You can kill anyone, anywhere, anytime.
It's the first thing you see on the video of for the Israeli Defense Force first version of the national anthem.
Right, yeah.
Somebody operating one of these machines, yeah.
So, you know, they're definitely, economically, they're suffering. I think 500,000 Israelis have left over the last year. You know, they're becoming a pariah state with all of the problems that involves for trading. I mean, it's all heading that way. The collapse of their economy is all heading one way. But then the PTSD that you speak about, I think, is really, really significant. The bottom line with war is that sending people, mostly men, although a lot of women in Israel, sending people out to commit atrocities in war, which is by definition an atrocious endeavour.
Not as an accident, but as an explicit order.
Yeah. But it damages people. Human beings aren't really meant to do that in large numbers. It takes particular characteristics of sociopathy or psychopathy to engage in that without it affecting you. In other words, what I'm trying to say is that, you know, people are damaged, mentally damaged severely by taking part in the atrocities in wartime. And you are not protected by the fact that you're doing it because you've been told that you're the chosen people and that everything that you're doing is entirely right and appropriate. Nothing helps you. Nothing stops you waking up in the night terrified by yourself at what you've done. I mean, that's just been demonstrated over and over and over again.
That's indeed. Yes.
There's a catastrophe unfolding within Israel, and I don't know what will happen. I mean, all along it seems that it's been obvious to the looking in on Israel that this is a particularly deranged government. You know, Netanyahu, just on the basis of holding on to power to prevent criminal cases proceeding against him, but then having a government that has these two truly malevolent far-right settlers in it, Itamar Ben-Gavir and Bezalel Smotrich, is a step up from anywhere that Israel has been before in terms of its government. And it's like, but there's no way, there seems to be no way of overthrowing the government, even though a minority of Israelis want that. The problem psychologically, the problem in Israel is that the majority of people are supportive of what is happening, even though I suspect a lot of them aren't really looking at any of the details.
I believe there was footage on one of the terrestrial channels of a rape taking place in one of these Palestinian prisons, which you would have thought would have just given people cause.
Yeah, I mean, again, the prisons is an interesting story. I mean,
I've just been covering that, haven't you?
I've just been covering it. I mean, it was the second part of a UN Commission of Inquiry report into what's happening, and their first part of the report was about the war on hospitals, which is so wrong and unforgivable. And then the second part is about the prison system, and the prison system has always been, the most revolting, brutal, lawless system operating in any of the countries under the umbrella of the West, because Israel is
included
in the umbrella of the West.
Yeah,
but you know the work that I've done on Guantanamo over the years, Andy, of course, has analogies with what Israel is doing.
Yeah.
So military courts rather than non-military courts for Palestinians can are prosecuted in military courts, not in civilian courts. And they have administrative detention, which they actually inherited from the British, when the British were the mandate holders in Palestine, where you can hold someone without charge or trial for 6 months, and that process can be endlessly renewed. So you can hold people for years and years and years and years without ever charging them with a crime.
It's a highly questionable legacy, isn't it?
And that is the defining characteristic of Guantanamo. That's it. I mean, with Guantanamo, it's not called administrative detention, and it doesn't have to be renewed every 6 months.
Sure.
but the parallels are there, and then so also the abuse and torture, and the rape and the murder that's been taking place in Israel's prisons for Palestinians also bears similarities, but to the very worst of what the United States did in the war on terror. So, you know, aspects of the CIA black sites, aspects of the way prisoners were treated in Bagram, which is where most of them were processed in Afghanistan, before being sent to Guantanamo, where a number of prisoners were murdered through the use of torture, and elements of how Guantanamo has run, which are all, you know, really truly sickening descent into depravity on the part of the United States, and all have their echoes completely in an Israeli prison system that has been running like this for decades. Actually, you know, since 1967, these systems were set up, and a million Palestinians have been held in Israeli prisons without proper due process over the years since 1967.
One would have thought, well, perhaps at not particularly great expense, but sufficient expense. You know, if you compare the cost of people in prison in the UK.
Well, yeah, I mean, you would think so, wouldn't you? Mm. But I mean, you know, there were, so there were about 5,000 Palestinians in Israeli prisons on October the 7th, and that has now quadrupled to 20,000 people. Pretty much none of whom are receiving anything resembling due process. And another parallel with the war on terror is that the International Committee of the Red Cross are absolutely, since October the 7th, or the week after, via Ben-Gavir, have been absolutely prohibited from visiting. You know, they're the international monitor of prison conditions. They've been absolutely prohibited, which, of course, the US did with its CIA black sites.
Yeah.
But didn't really do anywhere else. So it's accumulation of...
Right.
I mean, I was just right. I've just been doing some figures today. You know, 20,000 people is 25 Guantanamos.
Yeah.
So, you know, to see it that way, the entire prison population of Guantanamo multiplied 25 times is the number of people that Israel is currently holding in its prisons.
On pretty much on no charge.
On no charge, on people, you know, completely arbitrarily detained, and then in some cases also arbitrarily freed, because that's a that's a system of terrorism that they've had going for decades.
Yeah.
You know, you can't feel any safety in your life if your entire community can have people just plucked off the street, held for an unspecified amount of time, and then just dumped back out again, having been...
Effectively, it's proxy psychological abuse, isn't it? Say, the family structure or something. Or whatever,
So I think the Guantanamo analogy is shocking, you know, but the other... The other thing that I came across in the looking at the prisons is, you know, 20,000 Palestinians against 100 Israeli hostages still in Gaza is a ratio of 200 to 1. The death toll in Gaza, which is, you know, 50,000 known dead, but all of these understandings from people who analyze the costs of war, that actually the secondary deaths and the unknown people mean it could be 200,000 people.
Exactly. Yeah.
That's another 200 to 1 ratio. 200 Palestinian lives lost in the last year for every one Israeli that was lost on October the 7th. And 200 to 1 is a ratio that I identified years ago as the minimum death toll in Afghanistan and Iraq in revenge for the 9/11 attacks. The minimum death toll, 600,000 people killed in Afghanistan and Iraq by the US and its coalition partners in revenge for 3,000 people killed on September 11th, 2001.
Yeah, and,
so and Israel hasn't even finished. But that appears to be... I wrote it in a song with my band, The Forefathers, called How Much Is a Life Worth?
Yeah.
And that was about 9/11 and the wars that followed, and that's where I identified this 200 to 1 ratio. One Western life is worth 200 Muslims. Now we're seeing exactly the same thing in Israel. One Israeli life is worth 200 Muslims.
Bizarre comparison, but eloquently expressed in a song. Cue for a song, in fact. More from Andy Worthington in a moment. Oh, it's bloody genius. But this needs to be so much more widely heard, doesn't it?
It's just, it's unusual, isn't it? How it's not part of the mainstream narrative. It's like, I can find it. There are people writing articles. There are great people out there. There's a few fantastically eloquent speakers who get, you know, sizable audiences. But it's the absolute refusal of the mainstream media to call it out for what it is. That's such an... abandonment of their purpose, and shows, I think, what, you know, what Julian Assange said years ago before they locked him up in Belmarsh was, you know, I remember there's a video that's been going around of him saying, it's the media. The media is the key to all of this. The media has facilitated every war in our lifetimes. And they're doing it again. The weird thing this time around is that they're doing it on behalf of a foreign power. Do they think Israel is a colony of the West? Are they aware that actually the way they seem to be behaving is that the entire Western world is a colony of Israel? Whatever it is, it's like it's quite profoundly shocking that this isn't our own neo-colonial crimes that we're committing ourselves. We're fully supporting and endorsing neo-colonial crimes committed by what we can only objectively assess as the last great European settler colonial project, which is the State of Israel, and its necessity to subjugate and conquer, exterminate the Palestinians, to take over that land. The playbook is what we did when we went around the world taking people's land and appropriating it for ourselves. The days when, what was it, Andy? Was it three quarters of the map of the world was pink for the British Empire?
Something like that.
Well, and how many of those...
my parents' memory.
And how many of those didn't involve, you know, genocide and unspeakable brutality? We're not really taught that. You have to go looking for it. But when you go looking for it, the hardest thing is to look in the mirror and realise that, the most difficult lies to overcome are the lies that you've been told about your own country. Everybody wants to be the hero in their story. So national narratives want to make us heroes in our own story. And I think a lot of what's been going on the last few years, and the way the far right has seized on woke issues, you know, a lot of that started with a slave trader's statue was thrown into Bristol Harbour by anti-racist, anti-imperial, anti-colonial activists. And those of us who understood what that signified recognised how important it was. But the far right, the Brexit supporters who want a notion of Britain as, you know, as this great power that has somehow lapsed because of all these other factors that have nothing to do with them, they cannot handle that that a mirror's been held up saying, we weren't the good guys.
Yeah. Civilizations fall, don't they? I was talking to someone in another place on the show about something, I think it's called Cleonomics, which is the study of very, very long-range civilizational trends and sociologies and ethnographies across cultures. I have to go back to Graham on that one. But civilizations fall, and presumably somebody somewhere is having to plan for the fall the fall of America, as we know, should Trump get in, and very near failure of this country under Brexit, I think, and teetering on the brink in some cases, and still we see as we've just been discussing, Israel and various other countries like South Africa being apparently propped up by the Kremlin being propped up by China. China being a bit wobbly of late here, now and then, you know, the mighty fall. So the playbook, I wonder if we aren't on the cusp of some sort of shifting of the tectonic plates.
Oh, well, I think we are. I mean, I think, you know, what's generally ignored or demonised in the West is that there's a huge number of other economies that are not part of the West that are getting on with business without us, because we've actually kind of exiled ourselves as the dying remnants of an old world order that refuses to understand how things have moved. If we could see that properly, we would understand that you know, the West is dying. We're the dinosaurs of the colonial era and the industrial era who are refusing to take the lead on, you know, the most pressing challenge that has ever existed in human history, which is catastrophic climate collapse. We're the ones who should be in the position, having been involved in it all from the beginning, to say, oh man, the time's up. It's like this we thought this was working, it wasn't. Everything that we thought was progress has actually been hastening our own demise, because we are so powerful in our polluting abilities. We are making the planet uninhabitable, and it's happening really, really quickly. You know, the things that are happening now weren't supposed to happen until the 2030s. You know, I just watched footage of Valencia of, you know, hundreds and hundreds of cars swept up in unprecedented flash flooding, filling streets in Valencia like toys discarded by some angry giant,
and no readiness to respond just a few half an hour away.
Yeah, I mean, this is going to be happening everywhere, and we should lead by saying, by being, you know, unbelievably visionary, but we just haven't, yeah, we haven't got any of that. You know, and my thing I've been saying for quite a while is, if we had politicians who were brave, they could say to an electorate, you're not going to like this, and you're going to tell me that you're going to vote me out in 4 or 5 years' time. But I'm going to do, you know, I'm going to deconstruct radically our economic system to save us. And in 4 or 5 years' time, you will discover that I was right. No one has the bravery to address it. I don't even know what they're, do we know what they think anymore? What do they think, our leaders, about what's happening in Gaza? What do our leaders think about climate collapse?
Mm.
Because they're so studiously ignoring it.
Mm.
And the media, for the most part, isn't talking about it either. So
I suppose someone like Stalin needs to just make a quick call to his colleagues on the World Economic Forum to find out what he thinks about something. You know, the people don't get into positions of power sui disso necessarily, do they?
No, it's interesting. I think it's interesting because I think there's never been such a failure of leadership in our lifetimes, you know, and because we're facing unprecedented disasters, it's just mind-boggling. It's mind-boggling, really, being moderately sentient, Andy, and you know, looking objectively at what news you can find from all kinds of sources about the world, and seeing that this is demonstrably happening. You know, and yet our media still has to say the chances of this climate disaster happening were increased noticeably through climate change. As though, because there's a 0.001% of scientists, probably paid by the fossil fuel companies, to deny the existence of catastrophic climate collapse, they can't say 100%, with 100% certainty, this is happening. It is real. It is the worst thing in our lifetimes. They've always got to hedge it. It's just...
I believe Nigel Lawson's portrait was just taken down by Rachel Reeves, the head of the budget. And, of course, a man in later life, a vehement climate change denier.
Yeah.
And I suppose, presumably, does that imply that a lot of the thinking, or a lot of the, indeed, media-inflected thinking we're going to get around this is going to be revolve around what is economically palatable, so that we have the, as Reeves herself said, people have the sense of prosperity, whatever the reality is, or at least potential growth, whatever that might be.
Well, it seems completely empty to me. I mean, you know, we elected a government in July, which we didn't really elect them. We de-elected the Tories.
Mm.
And so Labour, you know, because of the vagaries of our system, got a stonking great majority, despite having fundamentally promised nothing, and now governing on the basis of almost nothing, and just not engaging at all. So, you know, they've just had their biggest ever donation, haven't they? But that's from a fund that supports Israeli weapons and is also involved.
I wasn't aware of this, but fancy that, they would say.
In fossil fuel companies.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And, yeah, I mean, unless people are prepared to be honest. I mean, the funny thing about it is that if somebody was able to be brave enough to impose change on the scale necessary to mitigate the worst effects of what's happening, it would be good for our societies. It would de-atomize us. It would bring us together. I mean, if you want the analogy that, you know, that older people talk about, it'd be that wartime spirit.
Mm.
You know, because there is a war going on. We're tangentially involved, or in a supporting role, we're involved in two wars that we understand. You know, wars between humans and their, you know, bloated weapons in Israel and in Ukraine. But in the meantime, a planet-wide war is taking place, and it's our war on the climate. It is absolutely a war, and we are absolutely going to lose it. because the planet doesn't care. The planet is a vast scientific entity which is, you know, chemically adjusting to what we have done to
it. It's a chemical reaction, isn't it?
It's a chemical reaction, yeah. And it's that you can't duck it, you can't run away from it, you can't, you know, this is beyond the denial point. This is like, look, if you accept it, you can't go, oh, I'll deal with that later. I mean, we've never been in this position before.
I suppose in terms of, it's not quite the same thing, but I remember reading past Clapham Junction Station and some graffiti up there, which I think is still there, that says, what if COVID was a great economic experiment, a reset? Now, we don't do conspiracy theories, but at the same time, there was at least an opportunity there to do things differently. Do you think, or would you agree with that proposition, and do you agree that something like that, were it to come along again, might be the opportunity, given the nature of political expediency?
You know, I think it was a... I think it psychically broke the leaders of the West, the COVID pandemic and the lockdowns.
So you describe it, the whole thing, the disempowerment started there then?
Their derangement started there. Their psychic derangement. Let me explain.
Yeah. Please, because, yes. I think you're onto something there.
Because I think what happened was that obviously, you know, we have learned since that some businesses, you know, profited immensely from it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people who deliver things. I think the pandemic was very good for people like Amazon, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah.
You know, and it created a whole, you know, a whole subculture of deliveries where, you know, people don't even walk down to their local shop now because someone will bring.
Well, they might have something.
Food they order.
Yeah. Mm.
No, but these are all you know, capitalist enterprises that have made money. Huge sectors of the global economy made money.
It's the nature of, isn't it, that they spot, you know, an opportunity is spotted. And
but it wasn't designed for them.
No.
What happened was that, you know, that an unruly experiment in shutting down most economic activity across the world happened. And, you know, in an unprecedented manner. And emerging out of it, what I think happened is that our leaders, they couldn't cope with it. None of them could cope with it. I mean, they, you know, they absolutely couldn't wait to get back to business as usual when, you know, when the skies are full of aeroplanes, you know, hundreds of thousands of aeroplanes flying every day.
The material, this ritual's there for
the roads are back full of the 1.4 billion petrol-powered vehicles that we have on Earth. Everything had to come back full on as it was before. And what the pandemic showed in one way was a very different degrowth world, one in which, you know, we'd stopped just like hyperactively, you know, overperforming every minute of the day, a frenzy of consumption and self-gratification, you know, just madly beyond anything.
People could become dangerously healthy, at least mentally.
Well, there were elements of all kinds of health, physical health and mental health and decluttering. And there were, you know, I don't deny that socially it was very damaging for a lot of people, that isolation.
Indeed, yeah.
But I think what happened is that because of the reality of climate collapse, which our leaders don't want to deal with, I think it's kind of burrowed away at them deeply into their psyches, and they can't handle it. They're like petulant children. What's happened is that you've got to understand, all these people have spent 40 years praising neoliberalism as the great future that would create more wealth than had ever happened before. They didn't really believe in any of the trickle down rubbish that accompanied the rise of neoliberalism, but it's made untold amounts of money for the super rich, you know, in 40 years of funneling that from people who are poorer, creating inequality like it's never existed before. But climate collapse showed them that all of this was a lie, that everything that we've been doing has been leading to our own self-destruction through our overconsumption and our overuse of fossil fuels. And they can't handle it. And flailing around, they've ended up embracing total war and destruction and devastation again. And a kind of Second World War mentality. And it started in Ukraine. It started with Putin's invasion of Ukraine, when suddenly Putin became, you know, the purest example of evil, human evil that had ever existed in history. And we had that message pushed in the media, day after day, month after month. And the same thing has kind of happened with Israel and Gaza, and the way that our leaders have completely refused to. It's like they've burned every aspect of international humanitarian law. The same way that everyone turned a blind eye to what America did, you know, after 9/11.
Mm.
And this is a kind of updated version, but it's everyone, you know, centrists, you know, supposedly moderate centrists, full-on genocide supporters, you know, Green Party politicians in Germany are full-on genocide supporters and, you know, behaving like Nazis. And I think something broke. I think it's that. I think it's the inability to deal with the fact that that unprecedented political and economic and social change is required for our survival, and they can't do it. And, you know, they are the most creaking and useless dinosaurs that we could have in charge at a time when we need boldness and vision and rethinking. Because actually, those positive aspects of the lockdowns that showed us that we could scale things down, that we could prioritize human contact above everything else. There were some amazing insights into, in a lot of ways, what we've lost in the last 40 years, where we've commodified economically almost everything that we do as human beings and every transaction. I mean, if we took a time machine back to 50 years ago, I think we'd be shocked at how many systems of control of our minds and our desires and our appetites have been put in place, all of which is kind of deranged. And like I say, is actually, most of it contributes to a situation where we're killing ourselves.
Yeah. Well, that's a cheery thought. You put me in mind of the great anarchist Alex Comfort saying back in the 60s that most people in positions of power use the general public for play therapy.
Well, you know, that is my conclusion, Andy, but it isn't. I suppose it's not meant to be negative, because we're in such an interesting position where,
yes,
around the world, a majority of people clearly oppose what's happening, but we're not represented by our political leadership. We saw it in Britain in July. We were given the opportunity to ditch a screamingly bad government, so we did that. But their replacement promised nothing that addressed the things that concern us. And look what's happening in the United States on Tuesday. No choice. Tiny little aspects of political life and social life there are noticeable differences on some topics. But in terms of the big picture, two options that won't address at all what needs to be addressed.
Yeah, well, Galloway would say two cheeks of the same fundament, wouldn't he?
He does say that quite a lot, doesn't he? Does, yeah.
So really what's at fault here is the nature of the rotted nature of political infrastructure, presumably, in political thinking, which I think your argument about the psychological disempowerment, that all of these things being taken away, I mean, almost unwittingly, in terms of what some people would say is the intended effect of something like that, other opinions are available, that they are sort of hoist to other appetite somewhere, aren't they?
Yeah, yeah.
So what do you see rising? Do you see communitarianism? I mean, certainly locally it's quite powerful here, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, you know,
this is the anniversary of Extinction Rebellion, I think, amongst other things.
Yeah, that's right. It was. Mm. It was on Halloween.
Mm.
Well, I think it's interesting that that in the independent MPs that we now have after the July elections, some of whom were Labour but were kicked out of the party.
Yeah.
Independent MPs, Green MPs, Plaid Cymru MPs, and then a host of independent councillors around the country many of whom were also ex-Labour, who left because of Gaza in particular, and Green councillors, they all wrote a letter about the budget to the government saying, you are actually punishing the working people that you claim to represent. And you know, they touched on all those mean and pointlessly vindictive punishment of the poor policies that the Starmer government has got. You know, the two-child benefit cap, the bus fare thing. Just like, what on earth do they think they're doing? Mm. You know, why is there no one to advise them as to, like, look, whatever little saving we're going to make from this, the moral cost, the moral injury of how we're perceived isn't worth it. And then they also called for a wealth tax. And I'm pretty sure that a lot of people, if that information gets in front of them, that this is the left alternative. These are people from different parties coming together in a loose coalition. They all have, you know, they have aspects of power. Some of them are MPs, some of them are councillors. If that's a model that can get more publicised, why is that not going to appeal to people around the country? Because the people who are lost are the people, you know, are the people on the far right who blame immigrants for everything. It's like, come on, guys, this has got nothing to do with immigrants. This has got to do with capitalism and how capitalism is implemented by the people who have power. And if the way that we can get redistribution is to insist on taking money from the super rich and actually using it to, you know, to make tangible improvements to the lives of the poor, it's doable. So why are we stuck with the choice of two governing parties, neither of which will do it? And that's happening in so many other countries as well. So I don't know where it goes, Andy, but we are ignored, but we outnumber them.
We are many, they are few, as
something
said
somewhere.
Yeah, but
we are, genuinely think, you know, who knows the percentages? I mean, you know, once you start trying to analyse population behaviour, what we have in Britain is a third of people who never vote. Who knows what they think? They will not engage with any systems that have been put in place to let us know what they think.
Yeah.
Or not. You know, there's certainly, I would say, less than 20% far-right contingent in the British public that either, you know, support the remains, the shattered remains of the Tory party, or, you know, the Farageist, the absurd Farageist project. I don't think it's more than, you know, I don't think it's more than, you know, a fifth of the people at the most.
It's odd. I mean, they seem to be winning seats from Labour at the moment, but that presumably is a reflection of what you've just said about the inconsistency on like this recent budget proposes.
Yeah, and, you know, and I mean, and in the same way, really, I suppose it's like Trump, isn't it? It's like you perceive the charlatan, you perceive the far-right charlatan as offering you something that will be beneficial. But there won't be any benefits.
Elon Musk,
there won't be any benefits from it for you. They just simply won't. I mean, it's not going to happen.
It's this idea, isn't it, that's, you know, a small government, the Ayn Rand thing, sweep government down the way, as Ronald Reagan, I think, said back in the day, and you then have the power of the people. But the power of the people, as given the nature of the other structures like the contemporary media that play into this, are being relatively disempowered and safe.
Well, it's why, you know, it's why it's always worth looking at governments that decide to attack the judiciary, the independence of the judiciary.
Mm.
Whatever other problems with the judiciary, there remains a component within the judiciaries of Western countries which is absolutely independent of political control. So as much as sometimes you see rulings that are like, oh, well, they've taken the prevailing right-wing political view, judges regularly disrupt what governments plan because they're not coming at it from politics, they're coming at it from an understanding and a comprehension of the law. So, you know, the Brexit time, of course, we had that traitors within stuff that was going on when, you know, Johnson and his ministers seriously attack the judiciary. And, you know, Donald Trump...
And the Daily Mail.
Kind of suspect is, you know, quite hopeful about damaging all those parts of the judiciary that are not supported.
Well, they can put their men in, can't they?
Yeah.
Over there, which is a very odd system, it seems to me.
But, you know, I mean, that was Nazi Germany, wasn't it? You break down the ability to have a political structure, a civil structure that administers so many of the aspects of everyday life. And actually, the more you destroy that, the more it's just chaos.
Yeah. I remember Gordon Newman, who I hope to have on the chim sometime, of Judge John Deed fame, saying that the series he thought was withdrawn by the BBC because his plot lines were a little bit too close to what had actually been going on about 18 months prior in the back rooms of Whitehall about the separation of the judiciary and political decision making. It's one of those sort of arcane pieces of political football.
That
sometimes just rear up into the very present, don't they?
Yeah, they do. Yeah, I mean, yeah, I think it's important that we. I mean, it's crucial that we still have, you can't politicise every aspect of how society is run, because it opens the door to authoritarianism, doesn't it? And actually, you know, the trend towards increasing authoritarianism in our governments, whoever they are, if you trace it back, it's through laws that have... restricted our liberties on the right to gather freely, for example, or restricted our right to occupy land under any circumstances, restricted, you know, in recent years, the very right to protest in the, you know, as can be demonstrated by the fact that
those laws have not been rescinded, have they?
People are sitting in prison because they stepped off a pavement and marched on a road, slow marched on a road for 2 minutes, to very mildly inconvenience traffic, and are now sitting in a prison cell, having been given a sentence of several years because that has become a crime. So certain types of direct action, non-violent protests that cause minimal disruption have now been criminalised.
We're going to make an example of you sort of thing. Yeah,
I think they've always done that of, like, you know, making examples after certain things have blown up. This is everyday policing now.
Yeah.
This is the everyday reality of the criminal justice system, that anything that crosses a line into looking like it's even the tiniest bit disruptive can lead to a prison sentence. So that has to be repealed, otherwise the place that we're in is unrecognisable from the Britain that we have lived in our entire lives. When, if you look back through all kinds of disputes and protests and confrontations between the state and its representatives and the people, there is quite often some element of violence involved on, you know, one side or the other. Quite a lot of state violence, funnily enough, against people, but the outlawing of protest itself, when it looked like it could be even the tiniest bit meaningful in terms of, you know, in terms of securing a headline, you know, because people have to do things to publicise what they're doing, because they're doing it in the first place because they're being ignored.
I think you can even do a master's degree in King's College. And the story that the chap who ran Extinction Rebellion actually submitted to the court that what he was doing was actually this experimental artwork.
Right.
It was
actually part
of his coursework for which he was arrested. It was putting some graffiti on the front of the college or something like that.
Roger Hallam,
yes. Yeah.
Who's now serving 5 years in prison for a 20-minute Zoom call.
Most peculiar.
It's not right.
See, there were some who suggested he was controlled opposition, not me, but I mean some other, you know. These are strange days indeed, as John Lennon said.
Yeah, well, I mean, I can't see any basis on which it can be regarded as acceptable for imposing such punitive sentences on people whose only real crime is that they're trying to point out that our governments are not fulfilling the promises that they have already made about reducing greenhouse gas emissions to ensure that the planet remains livable. If they're doing that by taking actions that cause disruption to try and raise publicity for what they're doing, that's secondary to the fact that the main reason they're doing it is because our government isn't doing what it's legally obliged to do.
And therefore, in the long term, you would submit being a lot more disruptive to our everyday lives than it's being at the moment. So, well, people plough on, don't they? Presumably, Mr. Hallam's got his lieutenants. Greta Thunberg is still on the case. Such a brave woman, you know.
Well, she's really... they've turned on Greta because she
well, she was arrested, wasn't she, in Germany, I think, a little while ago.
Yeah, but she's got involved in fighting for the rights of the Palestinians and tying that into climate change, which, you know, it's like lines have to be drawn, I think. And but, you know, as soon as she did that, suddenly people who were tolerating her, it's like, oh, she's crossed a line, she's in the...
The Herbal Candles and NW3 sort of wilted a little bit, I suppose, didn't they, or something like that. Yeah. But, I believe she's wonderfully on the spectrum, but she's one of those voices who has endured.
Yeah, well, and I think she's, you know, I think she's fearless, which I think is...
It's the phrase, isn't it?
It's her type of Asperger's, so... You know, Because we're aware of neurodiversity so much more in the world now.
Yes. Yeah.
And, you know, we can recognise that that people can have extraordinary tenacity with certain types of neurodiversity where they're just not going to be stopped. You know, because they absolutely know that they're right. I mean, that's, you know, that was something
which in lesser hands is a dangerous commodity, but not in hers, I suspect.
Yeah, it can be dangerous. Yeah. Exactly, it can be very dangerous because... if you put the wrong people into positions of power and responsibility who don't have empathy. So, you know, that can be one aspect of people not being able to properly empathize. But I would say our bigger problem is still this sociopathy and the psychopathic tendencies that are taught into, you know, as part of the upbringing of the elite.
We seem to be sort of finding ourselves drifting towards a mental health theme here in terms of our overall well-being. It's wonderful to see you as ever looking so great, but I think we touched on this last time, R&R away from the fray. But if we could extend that to how people might best do that when they find themselves stepping up to the plate. If you're Greta Thunberg, as I say, you clearly have superpowers. You're Wonder Woman. But there are lesser beings on this scale. And if you take that coalition we talked about, the Truth and Justice Movement, or however it will describe itself, this is a mixed bag of people with human foibles tackling extraordinary odds. How do you think this is a conversation that people are having in terms of how they do this? Because you've also got to inure yourself against the kind of slings and arrows you get in political life. Not as Tony Benn once said, actually getting out of the system to spend more time in politics.
Well, you know, everyone has to look after their mental health. So, because I'm a analytical and empathetic person, then
great combination.
Well, yeah, but very difficult though because I can't really switch off the horrors that are happening.
I commend you for not doing so, but you
need a break. So, I went for a break in September. I went for a family holiday abroad, and I did not have a device, and I did not I didn't take my computer. I had nothing. My wife and son had mobile phones, but they didn't look up any news, nothing at all, for the whole period that we were away. And it was a massive opportunity to recharge, because that's what we are supposed to be as human beings, but we're actually caught up in this madness of the 24/7 interconnected world, and, you know, and all the stresses that brings with it. So we have to find a way to protect ourselves. But what I can't see anymore as being acceptable is abdication of responsibility. So, and the reason for that, crucially, I would say it has something to do with not not tolerating a genocide by refusing to engage with it. But it's the climate collapse. It's happening now. It will not be averted. Nothing will stop it. We cannot hide from it. We cannot run away from it. The longer we hide and run away from it, the worse it's going to be. We've never had anything like this in human existence before. So people who engage in their lives in a meaningful way, I suppose, Andy, with trying to address noticeable wrongs and injustices, and thinking that it's worth taking time to do that, because the less people do that, the worse the abuses will be. Those people are much more able to understand that we are engaged in a permanent struggle now for survival. And that means that everybody needs to find a way to be involved, because it is a total struggle. Struggle is the nature of existence for oppressed people around the world. It always has been throughout human history. It's a terrible situation that the majority of the world's population is in, I think. We don't see it in the West, and we've been encouraged to put up barriers about our own, our own self-importance and not to see things.
Which I see you benignly demolishing as we speak.
But, I think it's that. I think my understanding of life is that, yes, we need to find ways to relax and have fun. We must, the human bonds between people are so important.
Yeah.
But on issues, this isn't an opt-in, opt-out thing anymore. This is a struggle. And the only way we're really going to address it is by more and more people spending more and more time working out how to become involved in the struggle to mitigate the juggernaut of climate collapse, which is coming to Britain soon. I mean, we're lucky, yeah? We haven't had the monstrous flash flooding that has happened across so much of Europe. But something's going to happen here where it will, because so much of our media is parochial, something happens here, then it will become a story. The same as it did, you will remember, two summers ago, the summer of 2022, when we had the heat wave and the 40-degree centigrade days. Mm. And I remember that because it was the only 2 days that the weather forecasters started telling the truth.
Mm.
They didn't talk about the weather. They actually brought climate change into the conversation very directly. And then as soon as those days had passed, they went back to the normal. The weather is just the weather. The weather is like, the weather moves in mysterious ways.
But in fact, it should be front page news pretty much every day, is what you're saying, isn't it?
Yeah, and they won't do it. I mean, I saw a Guardian columnist write about this months back and admit that they don't do it because it's not popular enough. So a fundamental commercial model of news is that they have to keep their viewers sweet. I mean, it's become a deranged industry because there's so much clickbait and there's so much
infotainment,
rewarding of outrage, anything that provokes outrage.
Mm.
But the bottom line of responsible broadcasting and news gathering and news reporting across all media ought to involve responsible journalistic bodies understanding that they have to tell people uncomfortable truths. So if they're relegating uncomfortable truths and not making it the lead issue every day, then they're kind of betraying their responsibilities. And that's why I think the media has such responsibility, because they are the people with a platform to say to large numbers of people, this is what's actually going on. You need to wake up and pay attention to it. The only other people who can do that, I think, are politicians. The entertainment industry can push some of that message in some ways. But otherwise, it's not going to happen. And so I think they're compromising their responsibilities massively by not insisting on prioritising a story repeatedly because it is the biggest story of our lifetimes. However inconvenient it may be in so many ways. Is this going to make some people Is this going to cause mental distress to some people? Yes, it is. But why do we, so? But we can't do that. You know, we don't want to start a panic. And it's like everything comes back to what I'm saying, which is that none of that is applicable. Because if you don't talk about it today, it will be worse tomorrow. If you don't talk about it tomorrow, it will be worse the day after. It's an inescapable problem that we're in.
You could do outrage, but you can't do panic. It must all come down to good writing and indefatigable witnessing, which is your middle name and all of your names, Andy. Thank you so much. Great to catch up.